There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversations of the day? How do we enter into those conversations as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? So I'm sitting at lunch, and the table next to me is, it's got like 12 people at it. It's clearly like a staff lunch. These are clearly not people who probably hang out with each other outside of work. They're talking loudly enough that, you can hear the substance and the variety of conversations being had. And I'm thinking to myself, where is God in that conversation? Whose job is it at that table to bring God's perspective to bear on any one of a myriad of conversations happening around that table? Well, I got to tell you, if you're a Christian, it's your job. People don't need just another piece of our mind. They don't need another opinion piece, but they do very much need the peace which comes with the mind of Christ. So whose job is it at that lunch table, or whose job is it in it doesn't really matter where you are, in whatever context you're in, whose job is it to bring God back into the conversation and bring the eternal to bear on the everyday? That's your job, Christian. That's what you are in the world deployed to do. So if you need some help with that, we have resources posted for you online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for the email newsletter. You can share the podcast with somebody new. You can donate to the ministry. All of those things would be greatly, greatly appreciated. You can also like The Reconnect on Facebook. And you can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, here, first thing today in the show, we're going to welcome our Facebook Live audience, our friends on Facebook, for this Speak the Truth segment of the program. As we speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time, we want to hone in on one particular issue. So I'm going to hone in on the particular issue of name calling. When was the last time you were called a nasty name? Did you even know that your own name might be considered nasty by some people? What do you do when a statue bears the likeness or the name of somebody who we now regard as a villain of history? What do we do with names like Washington or Jefferson or Wilson or Yale? And heading the list of most offensive names today in America, Lee. Well, we're going to seek to understand this issue from the worldly point of view and then bring the mind of Christ to bear on it. So this was the strangest bit of news that everyone is talking about today. His name is Robert Lee. No, not the Civil War era Confederate general Robert E. Lee, but a young Asian American sports commentator who works for ESPN, Robert Lee. So he was reassigned from calling a game in Charlottesville, Virginia, between UVA and William & Mary because of his name. So it's such strange news that many thought it must be a joke, but the burden of bearing the name Robert Lee in America's current racially charged environment is quite real. So now, to get our bearings, let's consider this. Let's consider that according to a website called howmanyofme.com, which, by the way, there's only one Carmen Fowler LaBurge in the whole country. So howmanyofme.com, there are 11,518 people in the United States named Robert Lee. So what are we going to do with these nearly 12,000 people whose parents, with the surname Lee, which is notably the second most prevalent surname among Asian Americans, chose the third most prominent or most popular first name in America and called their sons Robert? What are we going to do with all of them? The Robert Lees of America today are learning what it's like to carry the weight of a famous or infamous name. But Christians have known this truth for millennia. The first time the followers of Jesus Christ were called Christians, it was an act of name calling. It happened in a town called Corinth in Asia Minor. Carrying the weight of the name of Christ in the world, well, for a lot of people, it's been pretty heavy. Persecution.com reminds us that Christians are regularly discriminated against, persecuted, and even killed. So, do you feel the weight of carrying the name of Christ in the world today? How many Christians do you suppose there are in America? Somewhat more than the 12,000 people burdened today with the name of Robert Lee. But are you experiencing the carrying of the name Christian as a burden or as a privilege? Is it the cross you bear into the world every day? Are people calling you names because you call on the name of Jesus Christ? There is a connection to be made in conversations today with all of the Robert Lees out there who are just trying to make a name for themselves in a world where there's already something about that name. There's something about the name of Jesus as well. All right, Facebook Live friends, thanks for joining us for this part of The Reconnect with Carmen LaBerge. That was the Speak the Truth segment. All right, what about the word church? Friends, back to my listening audience on the radio. It's just us friends now. All right, what does it mean? What does the word church mean? And how is the word church used in our culture today? So there's church little c, by which we mean like congregations, churches out there spread across the landscape of America. And there's capital C church, like the church of Jesus Christ, the bride of Christ, the body of Christ, present in the world today, constituted by all believers of every time and place. The church universal is another way of understanding that. So when we read a headline like this, we have to be captivated. It has to spark our interest and attention, and we have to lay hold of it, at least for a moment, and use it in our conversations with others to bring God back into the conversation. So here's the headline that caught my attention. How a group of refugees saved a church on the brink of collapsing. So let me share with you a few lines from this article by Bob Smentana. It's posted in the Acts of Faith section on August the 18th in the Washington Post. And again, it's how a group of refugees saved a church on the brink of collapsing. So of course, I want to immediately ask the question when I read the headline, what or who is the church? Because it's not actually bricks and mortar. What does it mean for the church to be saved, and who is her savior? And is the church ever actually on the brink of collapsing? For those of us who know that the gates of hell won't even prevail against it, we of course know that's not possible. But it's a provocative headline, and it leads us not only to read the story, but to have an opportunity to converse with others about the challenges that local congregations are facing today, particularly in rural America. It gives us the opportunity to have a conversation about refugees and how, as Christians, we're going to respond to that, and how receptive we're going to be to people coming to the United States from conflict zones around the world. So this is a story that grows out of Smyrna, Tennessee. Smyrna is, I'd say it's a little community about a half an hour from Nashville. So this is where the context of this story takes place. And at the center of this story are a group of refugees called the Karen people. And the Karen people are from Myanmar. That's their birthplace. That's their the place that they're from. More than 100,000 Karen people were located to refugee camps in Thailand, which shares a northwest border with Myanmar. But others, like the character featured here in this article and in the forthcoming movie that's about the same subject, this character's name is Ye Win. He was 16 years old when government troops showed up at his family's home in an ethnic Karen village in eastern Myanmar. He was quite a bit younger when he showed up at the door of a dying church, an Episcopal church in Smyrna, Tennessee. There's an entire Karen community that has resettled in Smyrna. And here is Wynn's testimony about the time, really the time just after he lost his home and his family and his community in Myanmar. And he talks about the arduous journey of being a refugee. And he says this: we are the people of God. Even if we are lost, away from our home, even if we are isolated, we are still close to God. God never left our people. You're saying to yourself, that sure does sound like the perspective of a Christian. Well, you'd be right. Ye Win is a Christian. In fact, he is the child of a missionary. His grandfather was the first in his village to become a Christian. So we're talking here about a brother in Christ who happened to have been born halfway around the world in a nation called Myanmar. He was persecuted because of his faith and became a refugee. So all of this story is going to be told not only by Bob Smetana in this particular article in the Washington Post, but it's going to be told in a movie called All Saints. It's a faith-based film based on this true story of this integration, I'll say, this resettlement of Karen refugees in Smyrna, Tennessee, and how they came to not only be part of a congregation in Smyrna called All Saints, but really how God used them to replant and bless this particular congregation in this church. So leaders at All Saints hope that the film will not only raise awareness about the issues that refugees face, but maybe give churches some hope for the future in terms of what the integration of refugees might look like in their own congregations as well. So, Ye Win shows up at the door of this Episcopal church, this failing Episcopal church in Smyrna, Tennessee. And what happens? What happens? You know, it takes a lot of courage just to go knock on a door for the very first time, particularly if you are a person who has been driven from your homeland, you've seen your family and your friends killed, you're now surviving in a foreign land that you barely understand, the language is totally new, but one thing that you recognize is the red door of the Episcopal Church. Because you're an Anglican, man. That's where you're from. Those are your people. That's my family in there. It takes a lot of courage even to go knock on the door of your family if what you have experienced in large measure is rejection. But this guy went and he banged on the door and he said, "We just want to come to worship." And over a period of time, not only did they worship there with the All Saints Church, they asked a question. I love this. They looked around and the Karen people looked around and asked the leaders of the All Saints Church, "Hey, can we plant some crops on the church property? It's perfect for farming. We want to plant some crops to feed our families and we can help the church out as well." So what God had given this Episcopal church in Smyrna, Tennessee was 16 acres of bottom land. Bottom land is the best possible place to grow crops. And so that's what they did. It's kind of a miracle. That's what Michael Spurlock says here in the article. He is pastor of All Saints, and we're going to actually interview him right here tomorrow on The Reconnect. We're going to have a conversation about the forthcoming movie and about his experience of receiving the Karen people into the congregation of All Saints. Spurlock says here in this article by Bob Smetana, "God had sent more than 70 expert farmers to our church during our hour of greatest need." So when we talk about refugees, a lot of times for Christians, we're talking about our brothers and sisters from places in the world where faithful Christians went between 1850 and 1950, biggest missionary sending time in American history. So during 1850 to 1950, Americans were sending missionaries all over the world. Those missionaries bore fruit, right? God actually planted the seed of the gospel in the hearts of men and women. And he's now sending a lot of those people back to the United States of America. That's who this young man, Ye Win, is. You know, he's the grandson of a first generation Christian who came to know Christ because of a Western missionary. And now he is a part of a refugee community here in the United States that has literally saved one local congregation from almost certain closure. So I don't know if you have looked around your community lately and maybe you've got some churches that their pews are virtually empty and their prospects for, for repopulating those pews with people who look just like them and come from backgrounds just like theirs is, it's just frankly not going to happen. And so I'm wondering what it would look like for congregations to have a genuinely outward-looking faith where we said, you know what? God put this church here for a purpose. Are we on 16 acres of bottom land? Maybe we should start a community garden. Maybe we should invite lower-income people in our community to come plant crops here. And if they don't yet know how, let's teach them how. Oh, we don't know how? Let's go find a farmer who knows how. You're going to get your hands dirty, but you know what? That's the point. Maybe you actually live in one of our urban deserts. Maybe you actually live or worship, right? We have a lot of urban churches that frankly are not, the membership of those congregations does not reflect the community that is now around those congregations. So what would it look like for those urban congregations who are probably actually now in urban deserts, which means it's a food desert. It means that there's no fresh food actually grown in the context of that community. What would it look like for you to, I don't know, I mean, maybe you don't need a parking lot anymore, right? Maybe you don't need whatever it is that you built to house 600 kids in Sunday school in the 1960s, you know, but on the roof of that building, you could plant a garden. What would it look like for you to look around and maybe even take a piece of vacant land, right? A distressed property near you and convert it into an urban garden. Just the process of tilling the soil together, just the process of inviting the community together to watch something grow that would actually produce good fruit, that would actually feed people in the community. That is going to help people taste and see that the Lord is good. That makes the gospel visible and beautiful to other people. If you've been wondering what evangelism looks like today, that's what it looks like. So you can grab a headline like this, how a group of refugees saved a church on the brink of collapsing, and you can translate that into your own community. If it feels like a local congregation is on the brink of collapsing, what might God be sending? God's arm's not too short or too, God is not too weak. God is not out of ideas. And God is not surprised by the distress that you're in. He clearly has in mind people who you already know, who you already have access to, who he deeply loves and for whom his son died. The question is whether or not you love them enough and you love him enough to risk enough to go out there and invite people in. Now, are they going to change things at your church? Yes. If you were to go to All Saints in Smyrna, Tennessee today, things are different than when that congregation was just all Anglo, right? That congregation now, is populated in large measure by refugees from Myanmar, the Karen people. And so there are some songs sung in Karen. And if you look at the Episcopal hymnals in the pews, half of the hymnals are in the Karen language. And you say to yourself, well, hey, we're an English-speaking people and people need to learn how to speak English. Okay, here's the thing. In the context of worship, God can actually hear in a multitude of languages simultaneously. God's actually not just a native English speaker. All right? Jesus actually spoke no English at all when he was here upon the earth. I know that is like a stunning revelation to some people listening right now, but he spoke Aramaic. And if you think that God can only hear from us in the way that Jesus spoke, you have missed the point of Pentecost. You have missed the point of Pentecost. The church is in the world to make the truth of the gospel available and known to all people in their own language. And so let's get busy doing that, even if it means we have to sacrifice something that is comfortable for us in our rhythm and context. Okay, efforts at church renewal, which is what this little congregation in Smyrna experienced. And again, the forthcoming movie is called All Saints, and we're going to talk right here tomorrow on The Reconnect with Michael Spurlock. He is the pastor at the center of the story. He now serves in New York City. But at the time that this all took place in 2007 and the years following, he was in Smyrna, Tennessee as the rector of the All Saints Church. So efforts at church renewal, church revitalization, this is big business right now because church pews across the United States are more empty than they are full. And so are their offering plates. So I just want to suggest to you, if your particular congregation, if your local church is struggling to meet the next or new generation of Americans, first of all, you're not alone. But there may also be a community of Christians in proximity to you who you simply don't yet see. So I want to challenge you to see your invisible neighbors this week. I can't tell you in advance what they look like because they're invisible. But I'll give you a little hint. They are people who are present in your grocery store and at your gas station, and their kids are in the school system, and they're probably making use of public health services, and they are invisible to you. Because they are trying to operate under, under the cover of darkness, not because they want to, but because they're afraid. They don't know anybody in the community well enough to even let themselves be known. And you and I both know that's really at the fundamental core of every human being. We want to be known. And we worship a God who also wants to be known and reveals himself to us. All right, friends. Let me talk quickly here about marriage, because marriage seems to be a continuing subject of conversation in our country. So I saw this this particular article about India. It's in the New York Times, and the title is India's Supreme Court Strikes Down Instant Divorce for Muslims. So this is by Jeffrey Gentleman and Shuhanshi Raj. And so this is, the dateline is New Delhi, India. And here's basically what happened. So in India, Muslim men have been able to end their marriages by saying the word talaq, which is Arabic for divorce. They could say talaq three times, talaq, talaq, talaq. And that's it. They could do it in person, by letter, or even over the phone. If a Muslim man said talaq three times to his wife, they were divorced. Now, by contrast, a Muslim woman in India seeking a divorce has to gain the permission of her husband, a cleric, and other Islamic authorities. It's much harder for a woman to divorce her husband than for a husband to divorce his wife, because he just had to say this one word three times. So the method of divorce was available only to men, who in many cases then threw their wives out of the house without alimony or any other financial support. So on Tuesday, this is a human rights issue. We would regard this as a human rights issue. And then in a minute, we're going to talk about the reality that this is also a religious freedom issue. And those two things are in conversation here in this piece. So on Tuesday, by a 3-2 vote, so it was not unanimous, the Supreme Court of India declared unlawful the provision that allowed for Muslim men to instantly divorce their wives by this threefold method. So you might say to yourself, I thought India was a Hindu country. Yes, it's predominantly Hindu, but it has a sizable Muslim population. And so Hindus who saw the practice of ending marriage by uttering three words as an insult to women welcomed this decision on Tuesday, but you can imagine that that same response was not reflected by some in the Muslim community who view this as a threat to a fundamental religious right, because they view marriage as something that is defined within the context of religion, not necessarily within the context of society or by the government. So I want you to think about that in the context of the conversations that we have here in the United States about the definition of marriage. Who, in fact, gets to define what marriage is or what it isn't? So does the church get to define that? Does the church get to define when it begins and when it ends? Does God get to define it? If God gets to define it, then what does that look like? Or does the state get to define it? Well, there really are layers of answers to this question, because there is something called civil marriage. Like, that is how marriage is defined in our culture. And the laws that apply to married people or unmarried people are based on whether or not you are married in the eyes of the state. Now, whether or not you're married in the eyes of God is whether or not you took her into your tent. That's it. Pretty much, you take her into your tent, in the eyes of God, you're married. So you want to condemn people who've been married multiple times. You're going to have to count how many times you took a woman into your tent, because that's how many times you've been married in the eyes of God. God takes the act of sexual intimacy that seriously. So that's, from God's perspective, you know, that's how marriage is. That's how he conceives of it. That's what it is. Now, it's certainly much more than that. It's a lifelong commitment, one to the other, till death do us part. Or as my husband and I like to say, all the way home to the Father's house, no matter what. And marriage has lots of benefits, not just the affection and joy of being with another person. But there's something called the success sequence. We probably don't have time to talk about it today, but if you Google success sequence, you're going to find out that marriage in our culture actually has a lot of benefits in terms of whether or not children are going to grow up in poverty. And poverty is actually one of the fundamental indicators of whether or not people are going to flourish long term. So that's really, you know, if we want to have a flourishing culture, we need to have a culture that understands the sanctity of marriage, and where you and I as Christians defend the sanctity of the marriage bed. And that means I'm going to as fiercely defend your marriage as I hope you would fiercely defend mine. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. If you want to help keep us on the air, hit the donate button while you're there. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
He started something good.
Friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and I'm unfinished. This is The Reconnect. We are seeking to put God in his place back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about, and we're talking about what people are kind of afraid to talk about. And today we're going to talk about the reality of brokenness. We're seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We certainly invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. And you know, you can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. While you're at the website, sign up for the email list. You'll receive timely equipping resources that are designed to help you reconnect the eternal with the everyday and bring God back into the conversation in ways that honor Jesus. Again, the website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. With us today is Steve Weens. He is the founding pastor of Genesis Covenant Church. He's been a pastor since 1995, serving congregations ranging in size from 150 to 5,000. He's the author of Beginnings, The First 7 Days of the Rest of Your Life, and he's here with us today to talk about a book entitled Whole. That's the kind of whole that starts with a W. Whole, Restoring What Is Broken in Me, You, and the Entire World. So this is a major undertaking. All right, Steve is also the host of a podcast called This Good Word. You can check it all out at Steve Weens, and Weens is spelled WIENS.com. So SteveWeens.com or on Twitter at Steve Weens. Steve, welcome to the Reconnect.
Hi, Carmen. Great to be with you.
So I am pretty sure that I am not alone in my recognition that the world is not exactly as it should be. And I recognize I am not exactly as I should be. And of course, I recognize others are not exactly as they should be. So you characterize this, you use the word for this as brokenness. Like that's the word you attach to that. So tell us what is broken in us, what's broken between us, and what's broken around us.
Well, Carmen, I think that's probably the one thing that we can agree on these days is that there's a lot of brokenness. And I think that ranges from our level of discourse with each other. That seems to be broken. Our relationships seem to be broken. I think many people these days are taking to Twitter and Facebook, and we're really out loud about what it is that's broken. What we're missing is a really good solution to how it is that we can move toward wholeness. And I think the temptation is to want to, you know, 3 or 4 bullet points that'll get us on the track to wholeness really quickly. But the kind of wholeness that I think God calls us to is the kind of wholeness found in the scriptures, which is a real journey full of pain and promise, lots of mistakes along the way. But if we take the journey of wholeness found in the scriptures, then we can begin to bring wholeness to the world.
So I think it's easy for us to identify brokenness. As you've said, we can all agree that, you know, something's wrong. I'm not sure it's as easy for us to identify, recognize, or even be able to describe what wholeness looks like. So can you describe what wholeness looks like?
Well, the Hebrew word in the scriptures for wholeness is a word called shalom, which is usually translated peace, but it really means a sense of completeness. So wholeness doesn't mean perfection. It doesn't mean making sure you make all the right decisions. It's a sense of first admitting the state of brokenness that you find yourself in, which I think is why I write a lot about the familiar characters of scripture, all of whom have these radical moments of desperation and brokenness. Not one of them, with the exception of Jesus, is perfect or even close to it. So wholeness is a journey that we take, and we take it by responding to the different invitations that God has for us. And so in my book, the first part of it is really 5 different questions that God asks us. The first is, where are you? And that comes right out of the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve find themselves lost beyond lost, broken and vulnerable. And instead of chasing them with shame, God simply asks them a question: where are you? And that's the first question of wholeness. We have to be honest about where it is that we're hiding. And when we're honest about it, and when we're vulnerable with that honesty with God and with others, then we can start moving toward a sense of completeness and a sense of moving away from brokenness.
So one of the things that you said that I think might surprise people when they think about themselves, I think that there would be some people who are going to say, hey, look, I know I'm right. I have the right information. I have Jesus. So I'm good. Like, I don't know really what you're talking about, that I'm somehow incomplete or lacking peace, but I'm here to tell you that I'm right, and I'm right about everything, and I'm good. Can you sort of speak to that spirit and then talk with us about what's the part in me that I have to, like, willingly participate in this process?
Yeah, I love that question. So first of all, you know, if we have the attitude that we have all the right information and therefore that's what makes us right, we have to have someone be a mirror in our lives and tell us that we are obnoxious, right? And that even if you have all the right answers about God, about the Bible, about religion, about Jesus, the Bible actually talks about that. If you don't have a spirit of love, and if you have all the right answers and are doing all the right things, you're actually just obnoxious. And I think we've met a lot of those people, and maybe we have been those people. And so we have to sort of admit that and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe I used to be like that. So there's a humility. There's a humility that is really required. And one of the other things I read about in the book in part two is the journey. And it's the epic meta-narrative journey from Egypt to the wilderness and into the promised land. And when we are in Egypt, in Hebrew, it's a word that really means a narrow place. So when we're confined to a place where we can't see and we can't breathe, what we need to be is released from that place. But once we're released, there's no nonstop flight to the promised land. We have to go through the wilderness, and that's seen over and over again. And the wilderness is a place where we lose all of our answers, where all the answers that we thought held us up no longer work. It's the place where we know where we've been, but we don't know where we're going. It's sort of that place, using a circus metaphor, that you've let go of one trapeze but haven't yet held on to the next one. And so there's a real wisdom that comes to people that do their time in the wilderness. And the answers that they used to be so sure about after they've found that they've failed and they've had to find God in a much bigger, broader way. These are the people that carry a sense of humility, a sense of brokenness in a good way, like that they're not sure anymore. They're the people that actually bring wholeness to the world.
All right, friends, we're talking with Pastor Steve Weins. The book is Whole: Restoring What is Broken in Me, You, and the Entire World. You can check it all out on Steve's website, steveweins.com. All right, so let's talk about that pathway of restoration, because, you know, we're Christians, but we're also Americans. So we're like, okay, I really would like the 3-point plan. If it comes with a poem, that's fine. So, right, like that's the challenge of this, right? Because you're probably speaking right now to a bunch of people who are saying, I'm in that narrow place. I recognize what he's talking about. I do not want to stay here. And I want to be liberated from the bondage that I'm experiencing, because there's no joy in brokenness. And yet what you now describe, that I got to spend this time in the wilderness, that I can't go over it, around it, you know, whatever. I have to actually go through it. give me some encouragement about what that journey looks like. What are the markers along the way where I can know I'm moving toward wholeness?
Well, Carmen, great question. I love how you've characterized the narrow place is the place where that you need God to break you out of. And there's a sense of dependence in that. But then once you've been broken out, if you follow the biblical story, again, you don't find yourself suddenly surrounded by wealth and success. In fact, you find yourself right in the middle of the wilderness. But in the Hebrew, it's so fascinating. The word for wilderness is a word called midbar, and it comes from the root word deber, which means to speak. And so over and over again, if you read the really tragic and beautiful stories of the scriptures, when people find themselves in the wilderness, it's the place that God speaks. And so you're not alone in the wilderness. And we find that in Jesus. We find that in Moses. We find that from Hagar. Many of the people that are in the scriptures, when they lose everything, what they find is that God meets them there, because the scaffolding that they've used to prop up, you know, their successes and all the other things, they've failed them. And so the wilderness is a place where God meets you face to face. And that can be a terrifying thing, but it's also a beautiful thing, because your true self begins to emerge. That cautious, vulnerable self that God made, that God speaks to and God calls beloved. And God calls you into a much deeper reality of living with God and living with people out of a sense of reconciliation instead of the endless loop of brokenness. So that's the beauty that I find in the wilderness. It's a place that God meets us with a word of hope.
So I'm glad that you use the word reconciliation, because one of the things that I think I experience in a journey, you know, toward wholeness, recognizing none of us is there yet, or at least I'm not, is that there's this ongoing, it's almost cyclical, it feels like there's a restoration or reconciliation that I experience with God, and that happens once, you know, that happens once in this profound moment of justification, but it happens frequently because every day I got to confess that I'm not, right? And so there's this reconciliation, this ongoing reconciliation with God. And every time that happens, there's this also the reconciling with the self. And what I think is beautiful about what you are helping us see is that is supposed to then be turned outward in genuine reconciliation with other people, so that the brokenness isn't, I'm not just dealing with the brokenness of sin within me, that broken relationship with God. I'm actually living into the wholeness, into whole relationships, and dealing with the brokenness in the world, in the culture. So can you speak
exactly
to maybe one issue that you would recognize in our culture today where you would really like to call Christians out and say, hey, This is a place where we need to be dealing with the brokenness in the world that God so loves.
Yeah, well, I think speaking particularly to Americans, and I'm an American and I love my country, and there's a horrific refugee crisis happening around the world right now that is stunning in nature. And many of us as Christians, if we're only focused on making sure we're right with God and even praying a prayer, which we need to do, and we're unaware of the tragedies that are happening around the world, and we insist instead on fighting with each other about theological beliefs and you're out and I'm in because you believe this about some theological point that we can quibble on, and we miss the heart of God in the world through poverty and the people that are really starving, literally. I think there's so much room for us to come together and really be good news in the world, not just in our heads, but through our hands and through our feet. And we have so many good organizations in the world, Preemptive Love Coalition, World Vision and others, International Justice Mission, and others that are doing such good work in the world, I think it's time for us to say, let's agree on the majors, and let's agree to disagree on the things that are debatable, and let's get to the work of spreading the good news that Jesus has come to liberate people from all kinds of slavery, certainly the slavery of sin, but also the slavery of poverty and injustice. I think that's one thing that we really need to get around.
Oh, I'm so glad that you lifted that up. Actually, in the first half of the program today, one of the things that we were talking about is an article in the Washington Post that's entitled "How a Group of Refugees Saved a Church on the Brink of Collapse," and it's about these refugees from the Karen people from Myanmar, and how God brought them to this Episcopal church in this outskirts town of outside of Nashville. It's called Smyrna, Tennessee. Anyway, there's actually, they've made a movie about it, and so it's going to come out next week. It's called All Saints, and the people who made the film and the pastor, of the congregation, certainly the leaders of the church now, what they're interested in is actually people beginning to see that God might be sending you a gift in the form of a refugee community, that we sent Western missionaries, 150 years ago to this community, and this is now the third generation of the fruit of that. And we're receiving our brothers and sisters in Christ. And so, what kind of Christians are we if we're saying, well, you don't look like us and you don't talk like us, so you're not us? I mean, that's not what the kingdom looks like.
No, and so, not at all.
So thank you for surfacing that as a particular concern and issue. And I think you would enjoy not only that article and knowing that story, but the movie, the All Saints movie coming out soon. All right, Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. It's Steve Weins. And he is the pastor of the Genesis Covenant Church. The book is Whole, Restoring What Is Broken in Me, You, and the Entire World. You guys can check it all out at steveweins.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at Steve Weins. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today on The Reconnect.
Carmen, this is so much fun. Thanks for having me on.
All right, friends, you know what time it is. It's time to go below the fold, where we lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you start and engage in conversations with others, may not on the surface appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles could change not only one conversation, but maybe the way another person is thinking about something, potentially the way they're living, right? That's kind of the goal here, change the culture, but change the culture not in ways that are like forcing people to change, but where you, by being present over the course of time in genuine conversations where you are literally living out the gospel with other people, they're like, I don't know, maybe she's got some good thoughts on that. And why does she have any good thoughts on that? Because they're not her thoughts, right? It's Christ's mind taking hold in the life of a believer and then working itself out in very tangible ways through our lives. All right, so I got two things today. I got a quick update on bathrooms. This is a bathroom update. You know, we have been talking as a culture over a period of time about who can use which bathroom. And so I think that when Steve is pointing out what are those issues that we are debating in the church, that maybe in the church we ought to not have as a subject of debate. This might be one of them, but this is a debate in the culture. And so we as Christians need to not only bear witness to the truth of the reality of the difference between men and women, and God's design in creation, that God made us male and female in his image. But also, what it means in our culture to be raising kids in an environment that is safe. And then also recognizing that there are people who are living in our culture with a genuine dysphoria in terms of their biological gender. So that is gender dysphoria is a reality. So there are people born biologically women who perceive themselves to be men, people born biologically men who perceive themselves to be women. And that's what this bathroom debate is all about. Well, in Texas, there was a bathroom bill in an effort to basically say only boys can go to the boys' room, only girls can go to the girls' room. And, here's the challenge. The challenge is that when we start talking like that, then we're going to get down into the definition of how are we defining boy and girl today, and who gets to define that, and who's checking, Okay, that is just not a conversation we want to be having in terms of what the government is going to be doing in relationship to bathrooms. And so I'm really not surprised that the bathroom bill failed. But it keeps this foment stirring in our culture that puts LGBT advocates or people who are advocates of sexual orientation, gender identity issues, it keeps these issues at the forefront of our public conversation, when really at the forefront of our public conversation ought to be other things. Other things at this point ought to be at the forefront of our conversation. And so I saw this article by Emily Miller, and it's in the Religion News Service. And because it has, again, such a provocative title, it leads us to have a really important conversation. So the provocative title is, "Why is sexuality such a big deal for the church?" Actually, when this was tweeted out, it was, "Why does sex keep popping up in the church?" And I thought, well, that is certainly provocative. And then when you print it out online, that's not the title at all. So there you go. More provocative on social media than in reality in print, but you get the point. This is a good question. Why are issues related to sexuality and gender continuing to roil in the American church? Well, the primary reason is, people who are interested in moving the church on these issues keep it stirred up, right? So if this is your issue, which Emily Miller does a very fine job in this article highlighting those who are keeping this a fomenting issue within the life of the American church, I think if we recognize that, look, for people for whom this is a justice issue, they are not going to stop. They're not going to stop. They certainly weren't going to stop, you know, once they had achieved their sense of success in the UCC. They moved into the Episcopal Church, and having brought it down, they then moved on to the ELCA, which was the Evangelical Lutheran Church, and having brought it down, they then worked on the PCUSA, Presbyterian Church, United States of America. She is now completely bowed down to the sexual agenda. And now, you know, frankly, they're working on more evangelical varieties of Christianity. And so if this is not a debate in your church, it's just because they haven't come knocking yet. My guess is it is a debate in your church. So here is how I would answer the question. If the question is, why is sexuality such a big deal for the church? Here is my answer. No matter what the presenting issue is, the issue is God. So if people keep bringing up sexuality issues in the church, it's because God is at issue. They do not like what God hath said. They do not like the way God hath made it. They do not like what God desires. They do not like it, Sam. I am. I should write a book about it. It should be brief and have funny characters. But this is the issue. The presenting issue could be any number of things. The issue is God. So when you are in conversation with people and the issue is sexuality in the church or the bathroom, let me just remind you, the issue is always the same. The issue is always God. And the reason that Christians are not willing to yield on this point is because this is a gospel issue. This is a gospel issue because this is about the created order. This is about the image of marriage between the Son of God and his bride, the church, which is going to be a reality forever. And this is an issue of identity. We're not willing to yield on these points because we actually believe that God intentionally made men and women in his image, and he made them to be in relationship with each other, one man and one woman. It's God's design from here to eternity, because it's also reflected in the bride. All right, friends, so there you have it. The issue is identity, and the issue is the church, and the issue, therefore, is the gospel, and therefore, we're going to keep talking about these things because they're not going away. All right, that is all we got time for today. This is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You can check it all out at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, share today's show with someone new, and have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.